My simple solution is that we need to stop the three C's. The three C's, in my view, are the contractocracy, corruption, and corporate welfare, because those three things are absolutely intertwined.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. Today I have in the studio Penny Bright. Penny has stood as a mayoral candidate in Auckland three times and as an independent in the Tamaki electorate for the last 2017 election. She is known for not paying her rates if the council won't open the books and works unpaid as an anti-privatisation and anti-corruption public watchdog. Welcome, Penny.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you.
Now, Penny, you've been saying that we could save a lot of money if governments and councils returned public services to in-house. Can you tell me more?
Absolutely, I can. The great myth of neoliberal Rogernomics was based on public is bad, private is good. But they just made it up. And what has happened is that locally, nationally and internationally, there are now thousands of billions of dollars that are being spent on the private procurement of public services that used to be provided in-house by council and government departments. And how I know this was back in 2010, I attended the Transparency International Anti-Corruption Conference in Bangkok, and we were told that in 2010, the global procurement market was $14 trillion. $14,000 billion. But of that $14 trillion, $2.5 trillion was estimated to be lost in bribery and corruption. And my little brain whizzed around and thought, my goodness, $2.5 billion, wouldn't that help to feed, clothe, water and shelter a few poor people?
Sure would.
And so, we're talking massive figures here, because the other thing is that international research that was carried out in 2011 by a United States NGO called POGO, Project on Government Oversight, they spent 3.5 years and they studied 550 different service activities provided at USA federal government level, and what they found out, and this is a staggering figure, is that contracting out is actually twice as expensive as former in-house provision of public services. Now, I mean, this is how we can hit on the head austerity, social warfare, this war on the poor. There would be a huge amount of money available to the vulnerable in our society who really need assistance if we open the books and cut out these contractors. Because as soon as you get into contracting, here's the rub. When you get into contracting, you get into contract management. And what happens is, it said, oh, council and government staff, bureaucrats, they're too dumb to know how to project manage contracts. So they bring in private consultants, probably a highly paid bureaucrat's mate, because who's checking? Anyway, so the highly paid consultant project managers the works contractor, and in so many cases the work is then subcontracted. So by the time you get to poor old boots and overalls that actually get their hands dirty doing something productive, you may go through three or four layers of pinstripe suit, clip, clip, clip the ticket without providing anything productive. And that's the rub in my view.
Well, we've been sold this idea that if everything's privatised, it's going to be more efficient. But, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day who is working, checking Auckland Parks, because the company that's been contracted to look after Auckland Parks, they're not sure if they're doing the job properly, so they've contracted somebody else to check that that company's doing the job properly. So you get little fleas on bigger fleas on the backs of dogs or whatever that saying is. I can't remember
yes,
what it is now.
Yes.
But, yeah, that's what's happening, isn't it, Penny?
Well, the thing is that my simple solution is that we need to stop the three C's. The three C's, in my view, are the contractocracy, corruption, and corporate welfare, because those three things are absolutely intertwined. When you get into this private contracting of public services, how is it decided who gets the contracts? And what we found in the unprecedented bribery and corruption case, the judgment that that happened on the 9th of December last year involving Auckland Transport, what that showed between one corrupt public official and one corrupt contractor, $1.2 million were paid in bribes over a seven-year period. Now, there are thousands of public officials and there are thousands of contractors. How wide and deep-seated is this problem of bribery and corruption? And the last point is corporate welfare, in my view. If there's never been any cost-benefit analysis that proves that the contracting out of these public services is a more cost-effective of public tax money or public rates money, then it's corporate welfare. End of story. And what really, really concerns me, because I've been a support person for people, you know, sometimes who are dealing with wins, and the degree of scrutiny and nitpicking and the social warfare where every little cent has got to be accounted for, compared with, in my view, the total lack of transparency when it comes to billions of dollars that are being spent on these private sector consultants and contractors, is just unbelievable. I mean, that's why I have disputed and refused to pay, first of all, Auckland City Council and now Auckland Council rates. It's over 10 years now, because the books aren't open. I want to know the unique contract number, the name of the contractor or consultant, a brief description of the scope of the work that's covered by that contract, the contract start and finish dates, exactly how much money is being spent on that contract, and how was the contract awarded? Was it through public tender, or was it a directly appointed contract? That's basic transparency, and it's the law. The Public Records Act 2005 has been the law for the last 12 years, and it states, Section 17, all public bodies and local authorities must create and maintain full and accurate records in accordance with prudent business practice, including those with independent contractors. That's the law. The law is not being implemented or upheld. And if this new Labor coalition government did one thing, which was to fully implement and enforce the Public Records Act, it would transform transparency in this country. Because how can you have cost effectiveness if you don't know exactly where the costs fall? And unless the books are open, and unless you actually do have those public records available for public scrutiny, because how is a public record public if the public can't look at it, then, you know, you cannot have transparency or accountability. It's just that simple.
It is. How is a public record public if you're not allowed to see it?
Yes.
Exactly. And now just tell me those three C's again.
The three C's, mm-hmm. The contractocracy,
mm-hmm. Just
corruption.
Say what the contractocracy is again.
Okay, the contractocracy. I mean, they talk all this talk about bureaucracy. Okay, yeah. Bureaucracy are basically so-called public servants that work full-time in-house at local and central government. But what people don't look at is the contractocracy, because so much of these public services, the actual work, has been contracted out. The contractocracy, actually, in my considered opinion, is far greater than the so-called bureaucracy. So the three C's are the contractocracy, corruption, and corporate welfare. Those three C's are all totally intertwined. And I don't know anybody else in the world that's saying what I'm saying, but I tell you, it applies all over the world. Focus on the three C's. Bring public services back in-house. Because the other problem, the other thing that we also need to do, we need to purge the public service of this infestation, in my view, of corrupt corporate cockroaches that are everywhere and that are out of control. Because if you actually look at some of these massive salaries that are being paid to people in the highest levels of so-called bureaucracy, like Auckland Council, if you check the background of these people, you will find so many of them come from the private sector. Now, where on earth have they learnt the culture of being a public servant, of serving the public? They come from galaxy private profit. They haven't got a clue about, in my view, about being public servants. That's not where they've come from. That didn't used to be their job. They don't have the culture. They don't have the understanding. In my view, they're there to look after themselves and their mates. And that's, I believe that we need to purge the public service and get back genuine public servants, because I don't believe that's what we've got now.
No, I would quite agree with you. And then, so taking that further, you've got the three P's, the public-private partnerships.
Okay, public-private partnerships. The purpose of public-private partnerships is sort of to take the highs and lows out of the capitalist cycle, if you like, and to provide a constant income stream for mainly big business. Now, how that was one of the key things for the Auckland, this Auckland super city for the 1% that was forced down the throats of Aucklanders and we never had a say. In my view, the most important recommendation of the Royal Commission on Auckland Regional Governance, which started under the Labor government, and it did, what happened was they recommended that council key infrastructure and trading functions be undertaken by council-controlled organisations. That didn't come from Rodney Hyde. It didn't come from National. That came from the Labor-appointed Royal Commission. And what happened was, in Auckland, we basically replaced seven democratically elected councils, warts and all. We replaced seven democratically elected councils with seven unelected, corporate-controlled, so-called council-controlled organisations, each with their own officers, each with their own boards of directors, executive staff, officers, cars, etc. So we replaced one sect with another, if you like, and we never got a say. And I made a big fuss at the time because I fought the super city literally from day one, which was the 5th of September 2006, the day of the so-called Auckland mayoral coup, with four then city council mayors tried to do a coup against Mike Lee and the Auckland Regional Council. They wanted to railroad through a super city, and they did an open letter to Helen Clark to help push this through. It didn't end up happening because a couple of us went and disrupted the meeting, so you've got no right to do this. Made a hell of a fuss and helped stop it in its tracks. But that's where it started. And those of us who have opposed the super city from day one, we knew that basically that council-controlled organisations have been the mechanism for the corporate takeover of Auckland. That's how they did it. We never got to pick the model. We never got to vote on the model. We never get to pick who's on the boards of these CCOs, their executive staff. We have very little say. And basically the public of Auckland, the vast majority of the public of Auckland, we have just become a giant cash cow, basically all pay, no say.
Well, I think the media really let us down on this, because I didn't know at the start what I thought about it, whether I thought we should have a big city or not at that point. It took me a while to figure out what I really thought about it. And so, and of course now, I think everybody would say it's been a disaster, because all of our rates have gone up massively.
Well, that's that's a key yardstick.
Yes.
You know, a key yardstick. And as a mayoral, if I'm a mayoral candidate, the point I used to make to people was the simple cost-benefit analysis you can do yourself from your own home. Since this super city was forced upon us, have your rates gone up or down? And don't forget in Auckland that on top of rates, there are water services, water and wastewater services, that are actually paid separately, but you've got to add them together. What you're paying for your water and wastewater services and your rates, you've got to combine them together, because some people think, oh, Auckland, you know, you're not paying that much in rates. You've got to add on the water services bills as well.
That's right, because they were both together. And I mean, when they started on about privatising the water, I was very vocal about that.
Yeah.
But I remember going on a demonstration and there were only 40 people there. I counted them and I was just horrified.
Well, the thing is this, that what I do know is that those of us who are making a huge fuss against the super city, we were effectively censored by mainstream media. And I mean, I find that as an anti-privatisation, anti-corruption campaigner, I'm now getting just more and more censorship. Like last year in the mayoral campaign, 2016, I ended up with 7,000 votes, which was a lot less than the nearly 12,000 votes I got back in 2013, because I was just shut out of the debate. Because I'm saying things nobody else is saying. I'm saying that we need to roll back this Rogernomics. We need to, you know, stop the super city for the 1%, because it was never set up to benefit the public majority. It never was. And on top of the contracting, which I knew was going to happen, because first of all, the idea was council-controlled organisations over this much wider geographical area, because they set up the scope for potentially public-private partnerships, because they're basically run by multinationals. The multinationals don't want piddly little bits, that they want the big stuff. So you help create the big stuff, the one plan for Auckland. That's what it was about. Bigger contracts for fewer, but bigger private contractors. But what I didn't understand, I do now, but I didn't then, was the extent to which the one plan for Auckland was actually democracy for developers on steroids. Because for ordinary people that live in their suburban streets, they weren't struggling with three district council plans, four city council plans, and one Auckland regional council plan. Who that was too complicated for was property developers. And that's who've pushed it. Because if you have a look now with this Auckland lunatic plan, that's what I call it, unitary plan, I call it lunatic plan, then what you can see is that there is very little local and local government in Auckland anymore. There is. I mean, how much say do you have on your own street if you can have a three-story building suddenly popping up next door and you don't get to know about it and you don't get to have a say in it? That's where you live. How is that okay? It's not okay. And what I'll be talking about later is what's happened in Tamaki, where this democracy for developers is just...
We'll go there in a minute.
It's just absolutely unbelievable. Mm. But in terms of, fighting the three C's, the contractocracy, corruption and corporate welfare, what's happening in Auckland right now, which is very relevant, is that the new Labor government has said that they want to introduce an Auckland regional fuel tax. And Mayor Phil Goff, when we were on the campaign trail together, he did say that he was campaigning for Auckland regional fuel tax, which I opposed. But the problem for Phil Goff, he was also going, you know, made the right noises about transparency. Well, the problem is this, that Auckland Transport is the Auckland Council-controlled organisation that controls transport in Auckland. But the thing is this, what a lot of people don't realise, there's no such thing as public transport in Auckland. How can you call it public transport if there's 10 private bus companies, 4 private ferries and a French multinational running the trains? The only thing that is public are these hundreds of millions of dollars of public subsidies of these private passenger transport operators. And if the private sector is so efficient, because that's why they got the job in the first place, apparently, how how are they more efficient if they need public subsidies?
Well, now, look, tell me that again. Who owns our public transport in Auckland?
Well, what happened was I did an extensive official information app reply, and I got this straight from Auckland Council. This is a couple of years ago now. But there's 10 private bus companies, 4 private ferries, and a French multinational running the trains.
And now, that's Veolia.
Yes, and my argument is that I believe that that the public should not subsidise what we no longer own, operate or manage, that it wasn't broken when, under the old Auckland Regional Authority. They owned the Yellow Bus Company, etc. But again, from central government, they just said, you know, you've got to sell it. And that the pressure to contract out, that's not something that Aucklanders or people around New Zealand, we never have big marches down the street. Yay, you know, we want to be ripped off. We want, you know, we want our public services privatised. We the public who pay for this, we never demanded that. It was forced upon us. Well, it's time to roll it back. But the big thing here is that I requested from Auckland Transport, please provide the information that explains exactly how much is being paid in public subsidies to these private passenger transport operators. Auckland Transport declined to give me that information. They claimed it was contractually confidential. Well, I'm sorry, that's public money, and we have a right to know. And so what happened was I made a complaint to, in my opinion, the useless ombudsman. And sure enough, it took about a year before they did anything. And then they basically agreed with Auckland Transport that they didn't have to provide that information. And this is what drives me insane, is that, in my opinion, the statutory third-party public watchdogs are really toothless, useless corporate lapdogs. I mean, I'm running rings around them. I don't have a statutory tooth in my head, but by making a fuss and asking the hard questions, and, you know, it's like, why is it my job to do their job? It's yes. Not okay. But like I said before, if the Public Records Act was being implemented and enforced in a proper way, this information about public money would be publicly available. So what I'm saying no to an Auckland regional fuel tax. I'm saying no, because how is that okay? Because that's going to really affect particularly lower income Aucklanders who need to do a lot of driving to get to work. That's who it's going to impact on. But why should poorer people have to carry the brunt when we don't know where potentially hundreds of millions of dollars are going in these public subsidies?
Yeah, well, we don't know the profit level
and
of
we
those
don't.
Companies.
No,
those,
we don't.
And they may be getting a pretty big profit, and yet, why should we be paying towards their profit? We should just be paying the cost.
Exactly right. And that's why it needs to be bought back in-house, because you take your little blue hop card. My question is, how much of the money that you've put in to top up your hop card, how much of that is going on private profit to those private passenger transport operators, the buses, the ferries and the trains? How much is going in public subsidy of those private passenger transport operators? And the last one, and this is very controversial, but we've had it proven in court that it is a problem, how much is being paid in bribes in terms of how was it decided who got those contracts?
Yes.
These issues must be addressed by this new Labor government. I worked very hard, as did a lot of people, to change the government, because I was deeply concerned at what I believe to be entrenched corruption in National. They've been uprooted, they're out of there, we've got new people in there, but we can't have same old, same old. We can't keep putting the burden on poorer people when we've got this just incredible rake-off of public money in an unaccountable and non-transparent way. That has got to stop.
Yes, well, I'll give you an example of a young man that I know who 3 years ago finished university and had to apply for 100 jobs just to get an interview. He got his job on interview. Now, he lives in West Auckland and has to drive every day to Wiri. He's been there 3 years, doing it every day. It's over an hour. It can take 2 hours if he goes in rush hour. So he goes to work very early and comes home early to miss the worst of the rush hour. Now, that is a long drive, and that fuel tax will affect him. And he's up there on one income with a baby at home.
Yes.
So these are the sorts of people where it's not going to be good, but the previous, we worked it out, with the previous suggestion for a fuel tax was going to cost $17 a week, which was road tolls. So I think this one is going to be slightly cheaper than that. But that was the original talk of road tolls was going to have been worse. But I think you've got a very valid point that we're paying money to, companies that aren't private. I mean, I got mad at the weekend about the parking, because a particular parking company that is the biggest one in Auckland, all the money that they're getting goes to Singapore. It doesn't go to any New Zealand companies. It's Singapore-based. So, and we're paying exorbitant amounts to pay in the city, which, you know, people might say, oh, well, this is good because then fewer people will use their cars. Well, it's actually not very good. For people like me, I have to drive to get to any public transport in the first place. Mm. And then I've got to find a park, and then I might have to pay for parking there anyway. And I currently have a sore foot, and so walking big distances doesn't work for me. So, you know, it's we've got to look after everybody. And certainly parking and all that money going to private companies really annoyed me this weekend.
Sure.
So we need to do something about this privatisation, but it's not going to be easy to get the companies back.
Well, the thing is that, first of all, we need to know where the money's going. And so my call for opening the books, like I say, that's the law.
Yes.
And the law is not being implemented or enforced. I may petition central government, this new central government, on that exact point. Nothing needs to happen in terms of the legislation's there. It's been on the books for 12 years. So why isn't it being implemented and enforced? Because people talk about, oh, the Official Information Act and how it's hard to get information out of central and local government. Well, excuse me, if the Public Records Act was being implemented and enforced, you wouldn't have to ask for it. It would already be there. Simple. And it should be there, because I don't believe you can have transparency or accountability unless you have proper written records available for public scrutiny. It's not complicated.
No, but you know, something came out that said New Zealand was one of the least corrupt countries in the world, but that doesn't mean to say that we're not corrupt. It means that there's massive corruption worldwide, doesn't it, really?
Well, in my view, New Zealand is a corrupt, polluted tax haven. We're a banana republic without the bananas. And when I was invited and attended the 2017 World Justice Project International Rule of Law Forum in The Hague, that's what I said. And I can tell you the eyebrows going through people's heads. I stated that publicly. I said that in my opinion, the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index, which New Zealand is supposed to be first equal in terms of the least corrupt country, it should be screwed up and thrown into the rubbish bin of history. But I backed it up because, I mean, I've been to 6 international anti-corruption conferences, listened to the experts, asked hard questions of the experts, read voluminous information, put my mind to the New Zealand situation. And if we're supposed to be the least corrupt country, well, we should be the most transparent. We're not. It's incredible, the lack of transparency. And what I'd now like to move on to is evidence of the lack of transparency. This is a horror story. This, in my opinion, is the Tamaki regeneration, actually gentrification scam. The question is this: how on earth do you have a 100% Crown-owned company called Tamaki Regeneration Limited, 100% owned by the Crown? The Crown shareholding ministers are the Minister of Finance, and it'll go back to being the Minister of Housing under this new government. This company owns $1.6 billion worth of assets, because what happened was, in Tamaki, they were transferred over 2,800 former Housing New Zealand properties. And guess what? They're not listed under Schedule 4A of the Public Finance Act.
they're not listed under Schedule 2 of the Crown Entities Act. And they're not listed under Treasury's list of Crown companies that are supposed to be monitored. That is unbelievable. So was this company set up in a proper and lawful way if it's not attached or scheduled to underpinning legislation that's supposed to cover what they do? How on earth did that happen?
They took the state houses, basically, and I'm just checking here. They've taken the state houses and they've put them into a Crown-owned... organization without the checks and balances that should be there, and then they're selling off the houses.
Well, I would like to give full credit to Nikki Roti, who's the former state tenant from 14 Taniwha Street, Glen Innes, who put up such a brave fight against the privatisation of state housing, because had she not dug her toes in... She asked me to advocate for her in the Tenancy Tribunal and gave me a letter of written authority to do so. So the first question I had was, who owns 14 Taniwha Street? And when I finally found out who owned it, it was shock horror. Hello? 14 Taniwha Street, this Housing New Zealand property, was transferred not to the company that everybody had been told was going to get these state houses, and that company was TRC, Tamaki Redevelopment Company Limited, 59% Crown, 41% Council. And their 25-page constitution made all the right noises about regenerating the poorer communities and Glen Innes, Point England and Pam Muir, you know, all sorts of noises, all the social good stuff that were going to improve that area for the poorer people that lived there. They never got one house. Who the houses got transferred to were Tamaki Regeneration Limited, different company, 100% owned by the Crown, so that's a different shareholding, different constitution. Their 7-page constitution made no social good noises, no mention at all about regeneration. They're looking after property developers and investors. That's a fact. So what happened was where the so-called scam comes into play, in my view, is using smoke and mirrors with similar sounding names, because people thought TRC, it was the same company. It's not been the same company. And I spent 3 months waiting for an extensive Official Information Act reply from Tamaki Regeneration Limited. And that was dynamite. I knew it would be. And what it confirmed was that although they had promised 7,500 new homes in Tamaki up to the 9th of August 2017, the total number of new houses built, 213, of which only 92 were so-called social houses, 39 were for sale for first-time buyers, and the last 82 were private sale. This is the scam, because property developers have been licking their slobbering chops for years over this prime real estate in Tamaki, and the whole real aim was to push state tenants of prime real estate, destroy strong existing working class communities. And the name of one of the companies is called Creating Communities. I mean, how
Creating Communities,
as how Orwellian is that, in my view? So anyway, this is a really big deal. There was a little video that was taken where I spend 5 minutes explaining this Tamaki scam, and it's had over 180,000 Facebook views. Not promoted, not boosted, not sponsored. The parcel has been passed, because I'll explain what's happening. And I've done a subsequent little follow-up video which explains the latest situation, because Nikki was forced to leave because she had an eviction order which had been signed by Tamaki Regeneration Limited, and she would have been thrown out on the street. But the baton has been passed on, that the property developers may think they've won the battle. The war has only just begun, because what happened was, I have contacted the Office of the Auditor General. I have contacted the State Services Commission.
I have contacted Treasury, I have contacted the Office of the Attorney General and the Office of the Solicitor General. Little old me, I don't have a statutory tooth in my head, but they are paying attention and they are responding, because I'm saying, how on earth could this 100% Crown-owned company possibly have missed all these audits? How come they're not listed where they're supposed to be? And what I'm going to do, I'm going to petition for an urgent parliamentary inquiry to stop this Tamaki scam, an urgent parliamentary inquiry into how was this Tamaki Regeneration Limited set up in the first place? How was that done in a proper way when they're not properly listed? And the other thing is, Tamaki Regeneration Limited will not say how much money private property developers have paid for each and every former Housing New Zealand property. It's public property. It's public money. Where's it gone?
Yes, exactly. And it's reduced the amount of state housing that's available when we have a housing shortage for people who are needing it. So, I mean, it's just a criminal. But now the shareholders in this company, because it's as Crown owned, John Key?
No. The Crown, the financial interests of the Crown, they're represented by the Crown, two Crown shareholding ministers. They don't personally own
it. It's represented. I realise that. Yes.
But what will happen is that they will transfer over to, as I understand it, to Grant Robertson, the new Minister of Finance, and to Phil Twyford, the Minister of Housing. So I would presume that they have been already advised, no surprises policy, that this Penny Bright's been making inquiries, blah, 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 and you would need to know this. But the point is that it's just unbelievable what's happened, because Originally, back in February at the Tenancy Tribunal, I had requested a list of all the addresses of these Housing New Zealand properties that had been transferred to Tamaki Regeneration Limited. And I got this jumbled up list that wasn't coherent, either alphabetically or numerically. And I spent a couple of days going through, starting from A, listing all the street addresses numerically. That took me some time. And then what happened was, with the help of a couple of different people, I got driven round and personally checked out 2,704 addresses. And I know the exact addresses of, there were 76 bare sections where there'd once been state houses, which had been either relocated or demolished. Bare sections, and some of them had been bare sections for up to 5 years. I also listed the exact addresses of what appeared to be 70 empty state houses. And this is why you've got people dying on benches outside churches, you know. And so how on earth can this be happening? So in my view, my opinion is, this has been state-sponsored land banking on behalf of private property developers. It's been outrageous, because the private property developers, I mean, like I said, we don't know how much they've paid for the land, if anything, but the longer the land sits there and is land banked, the more the property values ratchet up. They ratchet up. More money for them.
But the three MPs that were in the know about all of that were John Key, Jerry Brownlee, and who was the other one?
No, the three MPs.
The three that you mentioned to me earlier.
Three that were involved. Bill English. He was the former Minister of Finance, and when he became the Prime Minister and dropped the Finance Minister's job, Stephen Joyce, he then took over, and the other one has been Nick Smith.
Right.
They have been the Crown shareholding ministers. So how can they say they didn't know what was going on? Who's been keeping a check? I mean, I know, because I've literally gone around that entire Tamaki area and personally, physically checked myself. How do you work out whether a state house is empty or not? You look, are there any cars in the drive? Is there any washing on the line? Are there any shoes or whatever at the back, at the door, at the front door, any ornaments on the shelf? And when it, or some of them obviously aren't, they're boarded up. But that was the question to Tamaki Regeneration Limited. I wanted to know, can they please confirm whether or not these houses are occupied? And then they say, well, no, they can't, because what's happened is that the tenants have been separated from the houses. Once upon a time, Housing New Zealand was a one-stop shop. did the lot, okay?
Yes.
All nice and easy, all in one place. Then what happened was, back in 2010, there was this housing stakeholders meeting, which this was basically like corporate charities and property developers, and what they did was come up with the idea of separating the tenants from the house, and that opens up for two strains of privatisation. One is the privatisation of the land and the housing. The other is the privatisation of the management of the tenancies. They need to stop the sale and transfer of state housing. They need to stop the transfer of the sale of the tenancies as well.
Yes, and what people don't realise when people have to move from their home is, of course, children have to change schools. And all of this, which is happening anyway within the property market as people rent houses and then 3 years later they have to move again and so the children have to have a new home.
Yes.
And so on and so forth, which is really bad for our young people growing up.
It is.
And so that the bottom line, they've lost their neighbours, they've lost their friends.
Community.
The children have to have a new school, and any type of community has gone altogether. So I just sometimes despair. And then when we talk about the Panama Papers and what's been happening there with that's where I was getting the John Key from.
Oh, sorry. Well, this is a really big deal. What happened on the 16th of October this year was horrific. The Maltese investigative journalist blogger Daphne Caruana Galizia was blown apart by a car bomb. Hideous. Now, the reason why this is a big deal is that Daphne was the person that blew apart, from the Panama Papers, the links that tied in New Zealand foreign trusts with Maltese PEPs, politically exposed persons. So there's like a double layer of secrecy, like the Maltese tax haven, if you like.
So it
connection
was a tax
and then,
haven,
and, yeah. And then New Zealand double, because what's a tax haven? It's the secrecy where you can, but what it showed was the potentially dirty, filthy money laundering, criminal money laundering that New Zealand has effectively been involved in. Now, Daphne did that twice. She did that in about April 2016 when this news first blew up. Don't use that word blew up, but
yes,
she, you know, she exposed it then.
Yes.
And there's an interview that Radio New Zealand did with Daphne back at that time when she explained very clearly the connections between what was happening in Malta and New Zealand foreign trusts. Well, again this year, in about May, I think, again she found out more information, again linking Malta and New Zealand foreign trusts. And on the 16th of October, Daphne is assassinated. That's it. Daphne has gone. Guess what? 2 days later, it's announced on the 18th of October that former Prime Minister John Key is going to become the chair of the board of ANZ. Now, the ANZ was the Australian bank mentioned more than any other Australian bank, in the Panama Papers.
Right.
Now, the thing is this, that, when I went over to The Hague and I said that, in my view, New Zealand's a corrupt, polluted tax haven, a banana republic without the bananas, blah, blah, and that the Corruption Perception Index of Transparency International should be screwed up and thrown in the rubbish bin of history, well, that international forum was from the 10th to the 13th of July. Well, who comes over to New Zealand at the end of July is the top man from Transparency International, Jose Ugaz, U-G-A-Z. He was the chair of the board of Transparency. I mean, he's where the buck stops. And I attended a meeting with 200 people on the 1st of August 2017 at Victoria University, and I heard him say John Key should be investigated over the Panama Papers. 200 other people heard him say that in that room. Where's the media on that? He also said that at a meeting he had in Palmerston North, because a friend of mine heard him say that at that meeting.
That is incredible that the media did not report that John Key should be investigated on the Panama Papers. That is a drastic letting down of the New Zealand public by our media.
Well, I totally agree. I think it's a disgrace because, I mean, you know, me, I blow the whistle to my eyeballs bleed, as it were, but then where are the media picking this up? And I've given that information to key journalists, and whether it's too big and hairy and scary or whatever, I'm sorry, but in my view, John Key must be the most spin-doctored politician on the planet in terms of the myth that has been spun about Mr. Okie Blokey, New Zealand Prime Minister who could mix and mingle. In my view, that is just absolute crap. He's an ex-Wall Street banker. He bought his Wall Street ways to New Zealand, doing deals over dinner, doing deals over the phone, dodgy stuff. The office of the Prime Minister, in my view, was a hotbed of corrupt conflicts of interest, in my opinion. So really good news that Wayne Eagleton as Chief of Staff is gone. Good news. But the thing is that what's happened with Daphne Caruana Galizia, there has been a massive international outcry. People have been horrified. I mean, Malta's a little island nation state with 430,000 people. It's just a bit bigger than Wellington. And her blog used to have 400,000 people reading it every day. Yes. You know, but what's happened is that the European Parliament, they're involved now, because what they're basically saying was, well, you know, maybe we haven't been tough enough on Malta. We have European Union anti-money laundering laws, etc. Well, maybe now we need to really investigate to get to the bottom of it. My question is, if they do more digging with Malta's money laundering, will that expose more with New Zealand foreign trusts? Anyway, what is happening is that on this Friday, the 3rd of November...
Well, this is going to be broadcast on the 9th.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, anyway. Well, okay, so what's happening is that on the 3rd of November in Malta at 2 o'clock is going to be the funeral of Daphne Caruana Galizia, and I am going to help organise something in Auckland. The exact venue has yet to be confirmed, but those who want to help make a stand in support of the wonderful work that Daphne did and helping to expose that, yes, actually New Zealand is a corrupt tax haven, that we need to pick up the baton, we need to keep the work going so that, you know, that the work that she did, her memory will not be in vain. So I'll be putting the message out to try and get concerned, decent Kiwis out there. And because we're half a day ahead of Malta in terms of the time, that will be great to let people over the other side of the world know that people in New Zealand care.
Well, we'll see how many people have gone out at the point when this is broadcast.
Sure.
Yes. But, it's very, very sad if somebody stands up as a whistleblower, they're put in prison or blown up or things like that. I mean, it's corruption again.
Well, it's horrific. Yes. And that's the point. But often what happens is a bad thing can turn into a good thing. And the worse the thing is, the better the end outcome can be. I mean, it's like trying to put a fire out by pouring a 44-gallon drum of bloody petrol on it. And I believe that's been the effect of this murder of Daphne Caruana Galizia. I really wish I'd met her. I'm sure we're going really well, as a lot of other stroppy New Zealand mates of especially female mates of mine, I'm sure that we would have got on really well because... it's inspirational, the work that she's done, and I've made contact with her son, who actually works for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, because I have emailed them, I've asked, please help, can you please help investigate John Key and the Panama Papers, so that the request has gone out there, and at the event that I'm going to help organise on the 3rd of November, I'll have some placards there that will make that call as well.
Right.
John Key must be investigated.
Yes, well, he definitely should be. And I mean, of course, Nikki Hager said that very clearly in the Dirty Politics book, and amazingly, that seems to have gone to ground. I mean, it could have been out in the last election as well, waved around a bit, but it wasn't. But I think that there has been massive cover-ups, yes. massive cover-ups yes. of things that have gone on, and our media is complicit, and we need to say, stand up and say, look, why are you not telling us what's really happening? Why are you telling us about... you know, so-and-so beat up so-and-so and it's on the news and it takes up ages and, you know, instead of telling us what's really happening.
The big picture stuff. Well, that's right. But, I mean, what I take great heart from is the fact that, like I say, that little five-minute video exposing the Tamaki scam. And if people want to look at that, go to a Facebook page called Ask Why. And I'd like to give full credit to Liz Gunn and Conan, the cameraman, for helping with that. But that's... also how we can apply pressure, because those figures, over 180,000 views, mainstream media, those are sort of figures that they can't ignore. And I know that did help to a point and help to get some information out about the Tamaki, what I call the Tamaki scam, although I think it would have been great if hard questions had been asked of Stephen Joyce and Nick Smith about how come, you know... things have not been done in a proper way. How come we seem to have Democracy for Developers on steroids in Auckland? Because in my view, as an anti-corruption campaigner, the proven corruption that's involved in contracting and consultancy, that is nothing in comparison with what I believe are corrupt practices involved in property development in Auckland.
Well, it can go from... it can go from going out for dinner with somebody and then you'll feel obliged. I mean, that's sort of, you know, just minor corruption to maybe, you know, oh, we could give you a holiday in a nice resort on the Gold Coast for a week or so. I mean, it's kind of under the table, isn't it, this sort of thing?
Well, some of it is, but in my view, we're news... forms of corruption which are understood and legislated against in other countries, most New Zealanders have never heard of. I mean, who's heard of state capture, where vested interests get the policy they want then developed into law, but they do it at the policy level? And the place to look for state capture is at regulatory impact reports or statements. You need to see who the policy analysts have consulted with, because what they tend to do is use vested interests and treat them as if they're some form of independence, and they're not. And the Office of the Auditor General and the Office of the Ombudsman, both those groups in my view I've found to be spectacularly useless, but however, they are prohibited by law at looking at policy. They can only wait till something goes through the parliamentary sausage machine, comes out law, and then is the law being complied with? But this issue of state capture at the policy level, who's looking at it? Who's even heard of it? And in my view, it's a major form of grand corruption in this country. And another one is the revolving door, where people go from public office to the private sector, and there's not a quarantine period where they're not allowed to do that. The revolving door in New Zealand, in my view, is on permanent rotation at local and central government. And in other countries, that's illegal. Not here. The least corrupt country in the world. What a joke.
Going back to this state capture, this whole idea of influencing policy, I mean, this has been going on for a long time, really, because the sugar industry... were probably the first ones to do it, and then the alcohol industry. And I mean, in New Zealand, I think the fishing industry is quite involved in policy. Then, of course, there's all these other ones like oil.
Well, but what happened was the business round table in the Rogernomics days. That's what they did. They focused on policy.
Yes.
Roger Kerr, they focused on policy. Then, strangely enough, they got legislation which served their corporate interests. That's where they focused. policy fact.
Well, that, I can tell you, happened around about 2000 or 2001 because I was in business at the time and was invited by government to spend time giving feedback about what we wanted to see happen in government. And of course, I had an entirely different idea to everybody else there.
No doubt.
So I didn't get taken much notice of because I was a bit of a lone voice. But we had a whole day giving feedback, going from one room to another, explaining the things that we wanted to the Labour government. And then after that, I forget which building that was in, and then we went, I think, for a big dinner at KPMG. And we sat with all the ministers and chatted with them. So, you know, I've been there from the other side of it, and I've seen it happen.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's just the intertwining of public and private. Once upon a time, there used to be a line in the sand. What was public and what was private? And it's not now. It's just so intertwined. I mean, you take organisations, in my view, like the useless serious fraud office. I mean, if you've got a bribery and corruption complaint, they're supposed to be the lead agency to whom you make a bribery or corruption complaint. But there's nothing in the underpinning New Zealand Serious Fraud Office Act 1990 that even mentions the word bribery or corruption in their, you know, have interpretation of what these things mean, then it's not even mentioned. Mm. It's just unbelievable. And I've made a number of complaints to the New Zealand Serious Fraud Office where I've alleged bribery or corruption, and they've said, "Dear Madam, we've reviewed your complaint. We see no evidence of serious or complex fraud."
It has to be a line drawn in the sand, and that where you say this is just people socialising and this is where decision making and where corruption can come in. I mean, you know, I'd have liked to have seen health workers or teachers having the same sort of meetings that we have. But we're coming to the end of this, Penny, and so just to conclude, you're really saying that New Zealand is not the least corrupt country in the world, in spite of all the corruption that is elsewhere, because we're missing checks and balances in a number of areas, and also ignoring checks and balances in another number of areas. And those things need to be examined and exposed and resolved.
Yes. Yes, I am. Yeah, so that's what I'd like people to take from this little interview today, the idea of stopping the three C's, the contractocracy, corruption and corporate welfare, and digging in, return public services back in-house under the genuine public service model. And I believe that will open up billions in New Zealand of public money that can be used on the public majority instead of the corporate minority.
That's fantastic, Penny. And keep being the spokesperson. But hopefully after this interview, you won't be a lone voice. Hopefully some of the people listening here will say, hey, you know, Penny's right about this. We need to get this information out. We need to nag the media to get the information out. I mean, the bigger media than we are here. And really, we've got to sort out things in New Zealand because it's a mess.
Yes.
And this is one of the things, along with the banking system, that really needs to happen to take us forward. So, Penny, it's been great having you in the studio today. Thank you very much. And thank you for all your work.
Thank you for the opportunity, Lisa. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Cheers. This interview was sponsored by the Awareness Party. You've just been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week, 8 a.m. Thursdays, or anytime online at greenplanetfm.com.
I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ura.